Welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a podcast that's been stockpiling tinned food since before it was fashionable for the government to do so as well. My name's Corey Hazelhurst, and my partner in propaganda is Steve Haynes.
Hey, Corey.
Now, it's been a bit of a quiet couple of weeks for us, to be fair, in the Not Enough Champagne bunker. Steve's been bemoaning the lack of air conditioning. I've been crawling towards the end of term, feeling hot, exhausted, pretty much, I'm sure, similar to our Prime Minister herself, crawling towards the end of the parliamentary term. But I think the question that I want to start off with, Steve, is what tinned food would you stockpile in the event of a no-deal Brexit in March?
I mean, you can't go wrong with a bit of soup, really, can you?
I don't know. I thought about this, and my first thought was corned beef.
I feel like corned beef would be... It's one of those things where stockpiling it makes sense at the time, but you'd get sick of it very, very quickly.
Oh, I don't know. Corned beef sandwiches, corned beef fritters,
corned beef hash.
I feel like it'd be quite luxurious. I'm almost looking forward.
I mean, surely if you're going down that route, it should be spam.
I've never had spam. And the thing I found weird, actually, because it was Hilary Benn who asked our new Brexit secretary, Theresa May's tea boy, Dominic Raab, and asked about stockpiling food. And all the headlines were on the fact that Dominic Raab said the plan was to make sure we had adequate food, which, as has been pointed out, was not on the bus. But I thought the really disturbing thing was that Raab said it was wrong to say that it was the government doing the stockpiling, which seemed weird because it's like, we're giving it to Carillion then to do, or Balfour Beatty or something.
Yeah, I mean, there's two things there. One is, like, using the phrase adequate food makes it sound like it's not just there's a risk that things might run out. It's that we're only going to stockpile the bare essentials. What he needed to say was just there will be adequate supplies of food, and it just sounds so much better and just presents a much better picture of what the government's trying to actually achieve.
I get the impression that words are not necessarily, though, Dominic Raab's forte, because he also said, he was asked something we're going to talk about later, about the fact the Prime Minister seems to be taking control of the Brexit process. And he said it was just a case of shuffling the deck chairs and didn't seem to get that we only used that in reference to the Titanic, which are big industrial size scale projects which
met up
and meet inevitable doom in the form of a massive iceberg, which I'm guessing in this scenario is Michel Barnier.
Yeah.
Iceman cometh, Steve. And he's French. So anyway, in this episode, what we're going to have a look at is how we got into this mess in the first place, because we have missed 2 or 3 weeks. So we're going to try and bring you up to speed with everything that's happened and then what our takeaways are from it. We've spent 2 years chronicling the descent of the British government into incoherent madness. But we're not going to start with 2 years ago. We're not going to start with Maastricht. We're not going to start with the referendum in the 70s. What we're going to start with is December. That's kind of the chaos for this year starts then, doesn't it? And we had an episode back then and we talked about what's become known as the Northern Irish backstop, or if we're going to be technical about it, the Northern Irish wicketkeeper. It committed Northern Ireland to being in full alignment with EU single market and customs union rules in the event there was no agreement, in the event there was no deal. However, the DUP heard about this and they got very angry, and they then stipulated there couldn't be a border in the Irish Sea, which essentially means that you couldn't have different rules for Northern Ireland as you could for the rest of the UK. At the time, this was seen as a big win for Theresa May, wasn't it? And it's one of the few times where the Tories took a reasonable-sized poll lead around December, January.
Yeah, absolutely. The issue of the Irish border was a finicky detail, which was seemingly bogging up the negotiations with the EU. And, seemingly at the time, Theresa May's ability to negotiate some way to move past this issue was seen as a win for the government. Little did they know, or rather they should have known if they'd actually been paying attention, that this would come back to bite them further down the road, given it basically commits the government, due to the combination of what they agreed and the parliamentary arithmetic and the reliance on the DUP, to basically saying, okay, we've got to be in the customs union.
Ben Bradley, who is one of the 47 people who's resigned over the Chequers deal and business, he references the Northern Irish wicketkeeper deal in his resignation letter and says essentially it was a bad thing to do and it means that we can't have global Britain, whatever global Britain means. And basically that means he wasn't paying attention and hasn't been since December.
Absolutely. The European Reform Group wing of the Tory party have just massively dropped the ball on when it comes to the Northern Irish border. They were hailing the agreement at the time as a massive victory because, you know, it was moving things along and it was just a sign that the government was getting on with Brexit and so on and so forth. But they just were not paying attention to any of the details. If you look at the commentary from certain parts of the media, the sensible bits of the media that actually pay attention to these things properly, people pointed this out at the time. The logical outcome of this either means no deal or it means customs union membership for Great Britain. Because the fact that the DUP won't countenance a sea border and the fact that the Theresa May is dependent on the DUP for her majority means that that's not going to happen. So you're left with those two options. And Kelsa Priest, look where we are now. You've basically got plans for no deal breaking out and the EU basically snidely going, well, you could always just stay in the customs union, guys.
So is that you're getting ahead of you. So that was December. And then we had, let's zoom a few months. And so was it a couple of months? Actually, I have a feeling it was only 3 weeks ago, is that there was an agreement done at Chequers. And finally, Steve, 2 years after the Brexit vote, over a year after Article 50 been triggered, finally, there was an agreement in the cabinet of the kind of agreement that the British government would present to the EU. Unfortunately,
it lasted less than a day.
Maybe a day and a half. We never really got a chance to talk about it on the podcast, and we're going to try and slide past it very, very quickly because it's dead in the water. Not quite clear whether it was Boris Johnson or David Davis or the ERG or the EU or, in fact, the British government themselves who torpedoed the Chequers agreement. But it's kind of dead in the water. It's the equivalent of Owen Smith's chances of becoming Prime Minister. Essentially, what Chequers said was that, one, there would be a free trade area for goods and harmonisation in that area, but not services, which is basically cherry-picking, and it's not likely that the EU would have agreed to it anyway, but there we are. There's that. Second thing was there would be some sort of customs arrangements. Now, we didn't really talk about them on the podcast, partly because we'd rather stab needles in our eyes. But the British government, for most of probably February, March, April time, was debating two different forms of customs arrangements with the EU, both of which names you've already forgotten, and both of them were unworkable. But this one was Isaac Maxfield, I can't even remember which one it was now, but essentially the British government would collect taxes on the border for the EU as part of that customs arrangement. I think it's the maximum facilitation arrangement, I think. Either way, the EU wouldn't have wanted it, but they kind of had there was a sort of customs arrangement, but they couldn't call it a customs union because that sounds like staying in the EU. But that was torpedoed. It looked like it would be okay for about a day. Michael Gove came out in support of it, and then David Davis resigned on, I think, the Sunday evening.
Forcing Boris Johnson to then resign.
Because it's the only way that Boris is going to become Prime Minister. Boris Johnson gets the Daily Telegraph in to take a photo of him doing his resignation letter,
proving once and for all that this was totally a resignation on principle and got nothing to do with his leadership ambitions.
There were also several the Tory vice chairs who resigned, like Ben Bradley we've mentioned. Also some PPSs resigned, whose names we've already forgotten, but you can guarantee, listeners, their names will be the subject of questions in the Not Enough Champagne end of year quiz. And no one, not even their wives, will remember the people who resigned. And that all happened over the period of about a week, 2 or 3 weeks ago. And finally then, the week we've just had, last week, was the final week of the parliamentary session. Theresa May and her Chief of Staff, Gavin Barwell, proved what political geniuses they were by, at one point, speculating they might call an early recess. So Parliament was due to break up on this Tuesday, the 24th of July. They talked about maybe we should get Parliament to stop on the Thursday, so about 4 days before. I think essentially so MPs could go back to their constituencies and not plot, which is the most politically tone-deaf move I've seen in quite a while, and I'm a member of the Labour Party, Steve.
Yeah, it is absolutely astounding that they thought this was a good idea and that it would actually get through. For starters, the opposition is clearly not going to vote for it. It's such an easy win for them because they're guaranteed that you're going to have rebels on your own side of this. And it's the sorts of things where people from all different wings of the party will all find a reason to think that, no, this is just dumb. If for no other reason, then, you know, they don't think it's good for MPs to be voting to give themselves more holiday time, which is how it would be perceived.
Before that, though, and before this recess stuff was even going on, there were some crunch key EU votes that came up. And a lot of them were on the substance of the Chequers deal. And the ERG, who Steve's talked about before, they are chaired by Jacob Rees-Mogg, that wonderful social liberal. And they put forward, essentially, they put forward wrecking amendments to the bill. One of which, for instance, I think was from Priti Patel, basically said, well, the UK is only going to collect taxes on borders if EU countries do it as well, which was never, ever going to happen. There was another amendment saying that it would be unlawful for the UK to get Northern Ireland to enter into a separate customs arrangement to the rest of Great Britain, which again basically makes the EU's WikiKeeper plan completely null and void.
Yep.
Now, the government just caved into the ERG completely and accepted the wrecking amendments, which meant you had a bizarre situation in which a government minister, who's also going to be the answer to a Not Enough Champagne quiz.
I actually know the answer to this one, though. It was Guto Bev.
There you go. He's not going to be on the quiz then. He resigned to support what had been government policy 4 hours earlier.
And it gets better, because Guto Bev was, at least at one point, an ally of Boris Johnson's and used to work for Boris Johnson whilst he was Mayor of London. So you now have the even more ridiculous situation of Boris Johnson resigning out of principle, quote-unquote, and totally not about his leadership ambitions over the Chequers deal. The Chequers deal then being wrecked by the government, and then a government minister in the form of Guto Bev, who used to work for Boris Johnson, resigning from the government to vote for the deal as originally planned by the government less than 12 hours earlier.
To quote Ian Dunt, the government passed the law against its own negotiating strategy. Also what happened is there was a vote, and this was always going to be the closest of any of the EU votes on whether or not we'd enter a customs union with the EU, and there was a majority, I think, of about four. Mainly because, well, partly because a couple of Lib Dems didn't vote, which we're going to talk about on a later podcast because we haven't got time for them in this episode. Sorry, Mark. But also because four Labour leavers, I think Kate Hoey, John Mann, Graham Stringer and Frank Field, also voted with the government. So partly because of them, partly also because apparently Theresa May threatened to call an early election because almost, you know, nice seat you've got there. It'd be a shame if anything happened to it, like me coming campaigning in your seat. And then also because Julian Smith threatened to call. Basically, then there was a pairing round, which we'll talk about in the next episode as well. But not some very not cricket things happened.
But basically, chaos broke out at Westminster, and yeah, it was a farce of the highest order. And we'll go through some more of the details in relation to a few other topics of for this in the next few weeks.
Basically a combination of lying and bullying, general malfeasance, all of which, let's face it, made Gavin Williamson look more competent than Julian Smith, which is, if we're all agreed, I think the biggest tragedy of this.
100%.
We're going to probably talk a lot about the substance of Brexit on later episodes, because I feel like a lot of this year has been me and Steve in this bunker just trying to work out what the hell is going on with Brexit. But we're going to finish off just with four takeaways from the last 3 weeks. In no particular order. I mean, the first one is MPs still seem really quite ill-informed about the substance of the negotiations, about what's actually going on. We've talked about Ben Bradley earlier, just not really understanding about what the wicketkeeper arrangement for the Northern Ireland border meant. We've talked in previous podcasts about Guy Verhofstadt appearing in front of MPs and talking about how, with the red lines that the British government have, admittedly they got watered down the Chequers arrangement, but those red lines that Theresa May had meant there was some. The only way forward was a Ukraine-style arrangement, which surprised a lot of MPs, which it really shouldn't surprise them. Also, and I don't know if it's because the ERG are a bunch of disaster capitalists or they genuinely are really blithely ignoring the risks of no deal, but we have got a podcast on no deal. If Jacob Rees-Mogg wants to listen to it and promote it on his Twitter feed, that'd be very nice. But essentially, it would be illegal for flights to come in and out of EU territory. It would mean lorries piling up at Dover. MPs just seem to be blithely ignoring this or unaware of it. Maybe both.
I think it's ignoring it because it gets in the way of the ideology. I mean, a number of the European research group have been fighting this battle for decades, quite literally. And they have basically just reached the point where Brexit has become a facet of their faith. It has to work. It has to be possible. All of these things that are being said that might happen must be Project Fear, because otherwise they've wasted decades of their life fighting for something which is truly actually terrible. And ultimately, I think that's where we are with a lot of people. It's not about disaster capitalism, although I'm sure there's an element of that with certain Tory MPs. But for a number of them, it's just because they weren't well-informed previously, have spent so long campaigning on this issue, and now it looks like it might blow up in their face and be a negative. They've just had to kind of bury their head in the sand.
Maybe it's almost assuming that the EU will show good faith to us, even though we've shown no good faith at all during the negotiations. In fact, May's T-boy Dominic Raab was doing that this week, saying that, oh, we might not actually pay the divorce bill after all, even though the UK's already committed to paying that money. But for instance, John Redwood was talking about, oh, of course flights are still going to go between the UK and the EU, but it would not be legal to. Like, yes, they would go off in the EU in the same way that if, Steve, you joined a golf club and then you left that golf club, people would still play golf in that golf club, but you couldn't go to the golf club and play golf there because you wouldn't be a member there anymore. And I think that's the key thing, is that any acknowledgement that there's not going to be a deal already presupposes that there are arrangements like flights, like food in place, which there wouldn't be.
And this is where really the kind of the granular details of the Brexit negotiations seem to have been completely ignored. Because an awful lot of these things, I feel like if you just turned around to the EU and said, okay, here's the list of all the arrangements we want to just copy and paste, for the most part, they're going to be fine with it because they don't want to be in a situation where you can't fly from Germany to the UK or from Amsterdam to the UK. They want those things to continue because it's good for their economy. But rather than kind of going in with just like a load of easy kind of wins and saying, okay, we want to do this, we want to stay in the aviation agreement, we want to stay in the security and terrorism agreements, and we'll continue paying whatever dues are relevant for all of that. We've ended up spending all of our time trying to wrangle out our position on the massive details or on the massive picture, which has meant the finer details have been completely ignored.
That I'm going to use that to get on to the second thing. So you're right in that we've not really still talked about that compromise between access to the single market and freedom to do what we want. In the EU's been very, very clear from the start that we can't cherry pick. We can't have single market for goods and not services. The four freedoms of the single market are indivisible. They've been very clear on that. We've tried to wiggle around it. There isn't really any wiggle room there. And essentially, we want to be part of that market for our business, which means that we'll have less freedom to set our laws. But if we have more freedom to set our laws, then businesses have less access and they're less profitable. That kind of gets us onto the second thing, I think, which is there isn't really a commons majority at the moment for anything. And one thing that Theresa May has said as Prime Minister, as well as Brexit means Brexit, she's also not really used the terms hard Brexit and soft Brexit. And whenever she's asked in interviews about them, she's always basically just rejected the terms as meaningless and not really assumed that they mean anything. You can kind of see a little bit of that point over the last couple of weeks or so, because even those more Remainy MPs who do want a softer Brexit, in that when it comes down to the trade-off between access to the single market and the freedom to do what we want. They want a soft Brexit where we have more access and less freedom, if you want to put it like that. They still can't agree on, do we want EEA? Are we going to be part of that customs union? Is it a customs arrangement? Are we instead just going to try and full-blown stay in the EU altogether and have a people's vote? It's really, really unclear on that side. But then the Brexiters, as we've seen, have no plan themselves either.
Yeah, basically it is very much a case of Britain being trapped between a rock and a hard place, because there's nothing really that can get through Parliament necessarily. We saw how close that customs union vote was, and whilst it is entirely possible that that could have gone the other way and we could have voted to remain in the customs union if things had been slightly different, the reality is the narrowness of that shows that there's not a lot of agreement other than maybe on that. And even then, it's not agreement in the sense of everybody in the Houses of Commons agrees that it's a good or a bad thing. It's just completely divided, almost 50-50. And, you know, that creates a massive number of challenges, which you just cannot operate and actually get behind and do anything about.
It would tax a politically astute, talented Prime Minister with a talented team around her. And we don't have that.
I genuinely feel like neither Blair at his kind of peak, nor Thatcher at hers, or Attlee or Churchill or whoever, insert your favourite Prime Minister here at their peak, would be able to kind of navigate this particularly well. I think the only thing I could, I'm sure we might be able to agree on, is that Anthony Eden would probably find a way to screw it up even more than May has.
How Thatcher would have handled this Parliament is an interesting parlour game we should play, maybe drunkenly on a different podcast. Third thing then, number 10 is taking more control over the negotiations. So a couple of years ago, the three Brexiteers, as I believe we were meant to call them, disgraced former Defence Secretary Liam Fox and David Davis and Boris Johnson, were appointed to the cabinet, essentially to look over the Brexit process, and Priti Patel was made Secretary for International Development. So any foreign-facing cabinet role was appointed, a Brexiter was appointed to. And I suppose at the time, some people thought that was quite sensible. It seemed like it was the Brexit, like May was trying to get the Brexiters to own Brexit and they would take the blame if it falls. What's clear 2 years on is A, they didn't have a plan at all, and B, they weren't really interested in taking any responsibility. They'll just shout betrayal and blame May and the Remainers. But what has happened slowly is, and this happened under Davis as well, is that number 10 has taken more and more responsibility from the exiting the EU department. And I think it's May and her civil servant who's in charge of negotiating Brexit. Ollie Robbins was taking more and more of Davis's civil servants, was doing more of the negotiating time. England spent more minutes playing in the World Cup this year than David Davis spent negotiating with Michel Barnier this year. I think it was like 4 hours, wasn't it, he was in charge. And one of the stories that came out on the final day of Parliament this year was number 10 is taking full control of the Brexit negotiations. It will be directly May or Robbins with Barnier, and Dominic Raab essentially has been sidelined, hasn't he?
Yeah, Raab has basically been given the duty of preparing Britain for a possible no deal Brexit.
Corned beef, that's what I'm saying. Not spam, not soup, corned beef, Dominic, that's what I'm saying.
The interesting thing about this, though, is that there's been some briefing from number 10, basically implying, well, actually, this was what it was meant to be all along, and that it was only David Davis's ego which was actually getting in the way of things, and that Davis wasn't meant to be taking the lead on negotiations with the EU. That was always meant to be Robbins, that was always meant to be Theresa May, but it's just he just wouldn't actually let that happen. So there's some interesting little tidbits which have been leaked out, seemingly, you know, the veracity of statements like that are always should be taken with a pinch of salt. There's some definite spinning going on there.
I think that might end up being a slightly generous interpretation of history, given that wasn't it Theresa May in the general election who basically talked about the EU trying to interfere and sabotage a British election?
Yes.
I'm not sure we can blame David Davis entirely. He wasn't the one who gave a speech saying that the Britain had to be out of the single market and out of the customs union and out of every single European agency and the ECJ. Now, David Davis didn't do a lot. He was a little bit of a failure, but you can't blame it all on him. And to somehow claim that Theresa May has been some sort of bystander through all of this is disingenuous, to say the least.
And also not a good look for her, because it just implies that she hasn't been able to control.
And that can't be true, can it, Steve? Yeah. No. Oh, God. Right, so final thing. Now, I've got on my notepad here, public opinion shifting. Now, we are not going to talk about the people's vote yet, other than to say that obviously the best thing that could have happened to the idea of people's vote is for us to come out against it and say it was a bad idea. And since then, there's been some shift in the polls, maybe suggesting that maybe people maybe want a vote, maybe, but probably not.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's, and we'll probably spend a bit of time on this on another podcast, yeah, with some friends of ours who are much more pro people's vote than we are. So we won't spend too long on this, but ultimately the question is, what are you asking them? What is the question of that referendum? Because if you're saying, oh, let's have a people's vote, are you a vote between whatever the deal the government gets versus rejoining the EU is going to get a very different outcome to whatever deal the government gets versus a hard Brexit.
And there have been people that just including come out and talked about a people's vote, but, and also we don't have time. It took 7 months to legislate the last referendum legislation. We don't have 7 months. No. It's not going to happen. Like, win the battle we're trying to fight now. Don't fight your next imaginary war, please. Anyway, more on that later. But public opinion is shifting really decisively against the Chequers deal. Basically, everyone hates it. I think a year or two ago, it felt like it was Jeremy Corbyn that was trying to get Labour to a 0% solution on Brexit that both pissed off Leavers and Remainers. Theresa May's managed it with a Chequers deal in that it would essentially leave Britain as a rule taker who had to accept EU rules. There'd be no say in them. People didn't really like that. So Theresa May's personal ratings absolutely plummeted since. But what's also quite scary is that polling suggests that people are well up for a no-deal Brexit either. So no, I think a lot of what the British government's trying to do over the summer is say to people, no-deal Brexit would be quite bad. I know we spent 2 years saying no-deal's better than a bad deal. That's not actually true. Please make sure you've bought some biodegradable hummus.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. That's that. Oh, God. We have a podcast hopefully out in a week on Spain and the news that's happening there. And then the following week in August, it's silly season. So we're going to talk about trivial subjects like speculating on Tory leadership or the Liberal Democrats. Sorry, Mark. Or the collapse of the Liberal order. All of those funny things we're going to try and talk about over the summer. In the meantime, we have a Facebook page, which is facebook.com/notenoughchampagne. We have a website, notenoughchampagne.com. And we have a Twitter handle, which is No Champagne Pod. My Twitter handle is @paperbackrioter.
Mine's @acousticradical.
James Cram designed our logo, and Dave Depp is responsible for our theme tune, Plucky Good Times. Happy plotting, everyone.